From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. At the Washington National Cathedral today, five U.S. presidents gathered to remember the 41st. Among those at the state funeral who eulogized George H.W. Bush were his son, former President George W. Bush.
Of course, Dad taught me another special lesson. He showed me what it means to be a president who serves with integrity, leads with courage, and acts with love in his heart for the citizens of our country.
NPR's Ron Elving joins us from Washington. Ron, that relationship between father and son, both presidents, is rare in the history of this country. What else did we hear from the younger President Bush?
The younger President Bush put a great deal of emphasis on the family life that they shared, on the great sorrows that his father had endured, particularly the loss of a daughter when Donna Robin was just 3 years old, and what that had always meant to him and how he had observed that and how it had stayed with his father throughout his life. He shared much of the life between his mother and father and gave us just a little bit of a sense of both the saltiness and the extraordinary fondness between those two people over a marriage of almost three quarters of a century.
One of the speakers today was historian and Bush biographer John Meacham, who gave one of the eulogies. Here's what he said.
Abraham Lincoln's better angels of our nature and George H.W. Bush's thousand points of light are companion verses in America's national hymn. For Lincoln and Bush both called on us to choose the right over the convenient, to hope rather than to fear, and to heed not our worst impulses, but our best instincts.
Now, sitting just feet away from John Meacham were many former presidents and the current president, Donald Trump. How did you read into what he said there, choosing hope rather than fear?
Hope, obviously, is a word associated largely with Barack Obama because of his book titles. But this is John Meacham's own book theme about the struggle for the American soul. And he was addressing a much larger audience than just that front row, although, of course, it would be impossible to miss all those presidential faces and all of the contention between them and all the things that they stood for. I don't think there's been anything really overt that was directed at President Trump, but the veiled reference would have to be awfully heavily veiled. No veil could obscure the implicit contrast that was implicit in so much of what was said today.
Well, and we remember that it wasn't long ago at this very same cathedral that John McCain was remembered, and President Trump wasn't invited to that funeral. Today was the first time that President Trump has spoken to President Obama since the inauguration of President Trump almost 2 years ago.
There's been a good deal of comment already about how prior to President Trump's arrival, there had been chatting going back and forth between Presidents Obama and Bush and President Carter, who is sitting there, mm-hmm. and that there was seemed to be a certain amount of friendliness, actually, among several of these folks. And then, of course, the president and the first lady arrived, and things got serious, even a little bit stone-faced for a while. But, you know, after all, to be fair, the arrival of the president of the United States is essentially when the funeral becomes official and officially begins. And so all of that was appropriate mm-hmm. in its own way.
The last state funeral for a U.S. president was more than a decade ago after Gerald Ford died in 2006. Talk about the significance of this moment and how Bush's funeral compares to past state funerals that you've witnessed.
There's a tremendous effort made to have ceremonial continuity in these events. That is epitomized, of course, by the use of the catafalque on which Abraham Lincoln's body once was laid. Presidential funerals are organized and conducted by the family, of course, but also by the military. This is for a man who has been commander-in-chief, the symbol of military hierarchy and authority. It needs to have a certain ceremonial sameness and to show respect for the office overall. And to some degree, from some people at least, that remains the greatest imperative of these ceremonies.
In addition to being president, Bush was also vice president, congressman, UN ambassador, special envoy to China, director of the CIA, and he served in combat. He was a Navy pilot during World War II. How did he want to be remembered today?
You would have to say this is exactly the way he would have wanted to have been remembered. With all that I've said about the formalities, the greatest impression you take away from this whole experience, this whole event, is the extraordinary fondness with which he was being remembered by his most intimate family members and also by some of his oldest friends. This was not just a life of historical significance. This was a life that a great number of people appreciated on a personal level to an unusual degree, and that, I think, is the primary impression.
And clear from the messages from many of his speakers, including his son, George W. Bush, he had a sense of humor. That was part of today's events as well. NPR's Ron Elving in Washington, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
To world news now, Russian President Vladimir Putin acknowledged today he's not taking calls from Ukraine's President Petro Poroshenko. Moscow blames Ukraine for that latest flare-up between the two neighbors when the Russian Coast Guard fired on and then seized three Ukrainian vessels and their crews off the coast of Crimea. Russia says they'd been blocking the Kerch Strait where the ships were. Ukraine should have known, but the ships were in international waters when they were seized. And you'll remember that Russia annexed Crimea away from Ukraine in 2014, the start of a conflict that also includes a war between Ukraine and Russian-backed separatists in eastern Ukraine on the border. So pretty volatile. Let's check in with the BBC's Jonah Fisher in Ukraine's capital, Kiev. Jonah, this notion that these two leaders are not speaking, or at least Putin's not speaking to Poroshenko, how's that going over there?
Well, it's just a sign of how bad relations are between Ukraine and Russia at the moment. The point that Russia's president Vladimir Putin was trying to make was that Russia basically believes that this whole situation has been escalated by Ukraine for political reasons. They believe that President Poroshenko, who's the Ukrainian president, is talking up the possibility of a war with Russia for his own political ends, to try and save his own political career, because he's got an election coming up here in about 4 months' time. And certainly what Russia is saying is that President Poroshenko is trying to boost his own popularity by portraying himself as this great national hero standing up to Russia in a rather desperate attempt to give him a chance of winning that election in March, because at the moment the opinion polls show him doing extremely badly.
But what is true? I mean, wouldn't you have to stand up to someone who seized your ships? And by the way, what happened to the ships and, more important, the crew?
What happened 10 days ago is Ukraine was trying to send three of its naval vessels through this Kerch Strait into the Azov Sea. Russia told them that they couldn't. The Ukrainian ships continued going towards the Kerch Strait. And then we had a pretty bad escalating situation whereby initially the Russian ships rammed the Ukrainian ships. And then later that day, they were attacked by a whole group of Russian ships and Russian aircraft. And those three Ukrainian ships were taken by the Russians, and the 24 Ukrainian sailors on board, well, they've been taken prisoner by the Russian authorities. And it looks like they're now going to be put on trial, charged with illegally crossing into Russian waters. So that's the background to it. What we've seen since then, particularly from the Ukrainian side, is lots of talk about the possibility of all-out war between Ukraine and Russia, because this is the first time that we've had actual contact between military forces with the flags of Russia and Ukraine. There's been lots of proxy conflict over the last few years between forces who are supported by one side or the other. This was the first time we'd had official military-to-military contact, and that's why, particularly here in Ukraine, people have been talking about this being a new phase and the possibility of an all-out conflict.
Well, what do you think? I mean, do you think that's going to happen?
My hunch at the moment, having kind of watched this pretty closely for the last 10 days or so, is that this is being exploited for political purposes here in Ukraine. There's no sign at the moment that Russia is talking up the possibility of conflict. Indeed, if anything, Russia appears to be playing down the possibility of conflict. Now, what they're saying here in Ukraine is that on one side, there's been this clash in the Kerch Strait, and second, they're saying another reason that war is imminent is that there's been an escalation, an increased presence of Russian military along the border with Ukraine and in Crimea. Well, on that second note, the increased military buildup, That's nothing new here. We've had large amounts of Russian troops, tanks, military hardware, aircraft on the borders of Ukraine for a very long time. They have the military capability to basically roll in to attack Ukraine on pretty much one day's notice. So that has not changed. The debate really is whether we are really experiencing something new in terms of what happened in the Kerch Strait, or if that's an incident which the president here in Ukraine is trying to talk up, trying to exploit for his own political purposes. Because in the immediate aftermath of that incident, he brought in a martial law, effectively a military rule, across the border areas of Ukraine, those parts closest to Russia, with the very clear message to people that this is necessary because I've got intelligence that Russia is planning an invasion, planning an attack on us, and this is the only way we can prepare ourselves and prevent that Russian attack.
Well, we're going to have to leave it at that, but the idea of 24 Ukrainian soldiers about to be put on trial in Russia is pretty unsettling. BBC's Jonah Fisher in Kiev in Ukraine. We'll follow this story with you, Jonah. Thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
So through our tears, let us know the blessings of knowing and loving you, a great and noble man, the best father a son or daughter could have. And in our grief, let us smile knowing that Dad is hugging Robin.
President George W. Bush finally letting the tears flow as he eulogized his late father, President George H.W. Bush, as a gentleman, the last of the soldier statesmen, and someone who encouraged Americans to choose hope over fear.
Let's bring in our political strategist, Alice Stewart, Republican strategist, and Bill Press, a Democrat who hosts the Bill Press Show in Washington, D.C. Welcome to both of you. And I want to start just with your thoughts on George H.W. Bush on this day of mourning, starting with you, Alice.
It certainly is a day of mourning, but really a celebration of a life well lived. And so many people that spoke for him today spoke not about him as a president or as a hero, American war hero, but as someone who lived a life of respect and of one that really is about bringing people together. And certainly, you know, as John Meacham said early on, his story will go on by God's grace. Mm-hmm. And what he taught and what he leaves behind is a life of service, but also living by example and honoring others and agreeing to disagree. And while someone may be your opponent, they're not your enemy. And that is something that I think a lot of people will take away from this.
Bill, as a Democrat, what do you think of the legacy of George H.W. Bush?
As a Democrat, let me say I went down to the Capitol to pay my respects to President Bush because he was always a man, while I didn't disagree with him on every issue, a man and a president that I always respected and always admired. How could I not? He told me once he watched Crossfire every night. Right? I thought the service today was so beautiful because it was at once solemn, but it was also just filled with humanity and with a wonderful toss of humor that reflected the man that we were, whose life we were celebrating today, who was such a great patriot, who was such a good, decent person, and dedicated public service in so many different at so many different levels. But also, you know, humble and very approachable, and just a wonderful guy. I'm a big fan of his.
One thing I can add, there's so many moments in the service that stand out. But one of the first where you really got feedback from his children was when John Meacham talked about how this president, certainly very self-deprecating, but also he would lift people up when they were down. But more than anything, a very unique trait where he said, if you were soaring, he would reach out and savor in your success, mm-hmm. as opposed to trying to bring people down to lift himself up. If you were doing bad, he would lift you up. But if you were doing great, he wanted to experience that with you.
Let me just add one quick point following Alice's lead. I think when John Meacham said that President Bush's creed was, and I wrote it down, tell the truth, don't blame people.
Right.
There's not one person in that cathedral who did not think about the man who was sitting in the front row.
Well, let me ask about that, because it is a day of mourning and honor. But in that front row, among other presidents, was the current president, Donald Trump. And I just want to ask you, Bill, because we've been hearing from listeners a little upset that they feel that maybe George H.W. Bush is being whitewashed a bit. For instance, we had a story yesterday about his deep friendship with a lesbian couple. In fact, he signed a license at their wedding up in Kennebunkport. And someone said, you know, look, this is a guy who was part of the Reagan administration that didn't even say the word AIDS while people were dying of it. Are you whitewashing? And I'm just wondering if it's, you know, part of what's happening that makes it feel that way is that you can't help but hear comparisons to the sitting president.
Well, I think, sadly, our politics has gotten so divided that there are a lot of people who cannot see the good in another person if that person happens to be a member of a different party. I regret that. I'm sure George H.W. Bush regretted that. Listen, I'm not saying that President Bush was a saint by any means. There were things that he did which I disagreed with at the time and still do. Clarence Thomas is on the Supreme Court. I got fired from a job in L.A. because I opposed the first Gulf War. He approved the Willie Horton ad. You can go down the list. But look at the good things that he did. The Americans for Disabilities Act. He was a leader in climate change. He signed a tougher Clean Air Act. I think you and what he really showed was, you know, I think that he wasn't perfect. But also, John Meacham said it this way. He was an imperfect man who left us a more perfect union. And I think all Americans at a time like this just have to take a look at both sides of the man. And overall, George W. Bush, H.W. Bush, was a great president.
A couple of other things we want to talk about with both of you, starting with what's going on. Weeks after the midterm elections, there is now an investigation of election fraud in North Carolina. This is something Republicans have long accused Democrats of, but this time it is Republican Mark Harris who is under scrutiny. He holds a narrow lead in one of the last unresolved midterm congressional races, and our investigators are looking at whether a political operative collected absentee ballots of Democrats and filled them out for voters. Alice, what do you make of this?
Clearly, this is something that we need to get to the bottom of. I know Mark Harris. He is certainly a tremendous person. If there was anything going on untoward, he would certainly want to get to the bottom of this. But at the end of the day, it's important that we make sure that all the votes that are to be counted are counted. And if there's certainly any discrepancies, that needs to be investigated, because of anyone, Mark Harris would want to make sure that not just that he would win, but he wants to win the right way, and he will make sure that that happens.
Well, I want to go from there, though. Hold on, Bill, because you can talk about both, because we want to talk about Wisconsin as well. Republicans there passing laws that weaken the powers of the incoming Democrat, Tony Evers. He won. Make it hard to change laws passed by the outgoing Republican, Scott Walker, things like early voting restrictions. And here's the Republican Majority Leader, Senator Scott Fitzgerald.
I'm concerned. Yeah. I think that Governor-elect Evers is going to bring a liberal agenda to Wisconsin. There's going to be a complete shift in Wisconsin.
And we don't have it on the sound there, but Bill, some people shouted out, yes, we voted for him, and that's why. It feels between these two stories like something's unsavory.
Well, first, between the two stories, these add up to the midterms, I think, that won't stop, right?
Yeah, there's that.
But I was just going to holler the same thing about Wisconsin. Yeah, you lost, dude, and accept it. The fact is, one example of what they're trying to do in Wisconsin. By the way, we saw the same thing happen in North Carolina 2 years ago when Roy Cooper was elected in a Republican legislature before they lost control, just went crazy passing laws to try to limit the powers of the incoming governor. And in this case in Wisconsin, it's also the attorney general. They passed one of the bills in Wisconsin would prohibit the attorney general from getting back into Medicaid and the Affordable Care Act. That was a big issue in the campaign. And the people of Wisconsin voted. They wanted to be part of the Affordable Care Act. They wanted to be part to expand Medicaid. And now the legislature is trying to undo their vote. I think it's undemocratic, unconstitutional. I hope it doesn't succeed. Just a quick word on North Carolina. I just find it ironic that after all the talks about voter fraud by President Trump and by Kris Kobach, who lost in his race for governor of Kansas, that the one case of voter fraud that has come up in this election happens to be a Republican, on the part of a Republican, alleged in North Carolina, of harvesting votes, sending people out to say, I'll take your absentee ballot and I'll deliver it for you and vote it for you. And some people trusted them. They called it ballot harvesting. I've been involved in a lot of GOTV campaigns. That is clearly not allowed over the line.
Well, Alice, let me come to you for a second, because when you take these stories and what Bill was just talking about, and you look at now what happens when somebody takes control of the White House, and I'm thinking of President Trump, and spends a long time just undoing what the last president did, that's their main agenda, is to just undo, instead of just accepting this is what the voters wanted, let's move forward and do. Do you see a connection between the two?
Well, look, the president ran on specific issues, and he was elected to undo some of what his predecessor did. He campaigned on repealing and replacing Obamacare. They tried and made some small steps in that direction, but that's what he won on. And he campaigned on making significant changes with regard to immigration. So it's – I understand how – others would see this as undoing what the former president did. However, this is what President Trump ran on. And with regard to what's going on in Wisconsin, I've been there when Walker was running for reelection. Wisconsin politics is blood sport, and they are very passionate. There's a big conflict between the unions and Republican leaders. And really what's happening here is a lot of Republicans they made some changes back in 2011, and they're going back. And those changes gave more power to the governor. Now they're, as they see, the governor is not in their hands anymore. They're going to strip some of those powers. So that's what we see going on there. I'm not saying it's right. I'm saying that's what's going on.
The essence of democracy is you accept the results of the election. You accept the will of the people, of the voters. And in Wisconsin, they are not doing so.
That's Bill Press, the Democrat who hosts the Bill Press Show in Washington, D.C. Alice Stewart, the Republican strategist, weighing in on the news of the week.
And Alice is from the South, and she just said Wisconsin is blood sport. That's interesting. Thanks to both of you.
I've seen it.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
U.S. markets are closed today to honor former President George H.W. Bush, and maybe it's for the best, because yesterday the Dow plunged nearly 800 points, more than 3%, wiping out the Dow's 288-point gain on Monday after China and the U.S. agreed to a truce on tariffs. Let's bring in Claire Sebastian, business correspondent at CNN. Hi, Claire.
Hi, Jeremy.
So lots of troubling signs in the economy this week. The Dow falling nearly 800 points yesterday in the bond market. We talked yesterday about how the yield curve is now flattening out, as it does oftentimes before a recession. How bad are things this week?
Well, Jeremy, I think the difficulty that you have with this kind of volatility in the market is sorting out what's emotion and panic and what are really material changes here. And I think clearly it would be completely false to describe things as bad in the U.S. economy right now. We have unemployment near half-century lows. Consumer confidence is high. Economic growth is at 3.5%. I could go on. But obviously the reason why people are worried is because of what comes next. There's a growing school of thought that this may be as good as it gets. And as interest rate rise next year and the flattening yield curve, as you say, can be a signal of an oncoming downturn. That is what has got people concerned. But as for right now, things are still pretty good in the U.S. economy. It's what's coming next that has people really concerned.
So you wouldn't describe it as bad, but listen to how the White House trade and economic advisor Peter Navarro described the economy to me yesterday on the show. I asked him to describe how the economy is doing in just one word, and here's what he said.
Bullish. strong. Two words, sorry.
Okay, so bullish and strong. Is that overstating the health of the economy right now?
Well, look, I think this obviously includes a strong component of political spin from Peter Navarro. The last thing the president wants to do is to campaign for re-election when he's dealing with an economic slowdown. And yeah, he's right. As I just said, the fundamentals are mostly strong. We're in the holiday shopping season. People are spending. Wages are starting to finally tick up. What he's not mentioning there in those two words is the signs that this might not last. But I would say, as I said, I wouldn't describe it as bad right now. I think the warning signs are flashing yellow, perhaps not red right now.
And do you think that the pressure that the White House has been putting on the Fed is supposed to be independent. They're not supposed to listen to what the president thinks about what they should do. But do you think that the pressure is now building that the Fed may slow down its rate increases?
I think it's not so much the pressure from the White House as perhaps the pressure from the markets that the Fed is getting. Because don't forget, it's not just the president who believes that the Fed might be hiking too fast. There are a lot of people out there in the market who worry that the Fed might make a mistake, because sometimes by the time they've raised rates and they can see the impact of that, it's too late. I think there was some reassurance that we got from the Fed chair, Jerome Powell, in a speech here in New York that he gave last week, where he said they were going to look carefully at the data, that they might be not that far off the neutral rate. That gave the market some reassurance. But we've seen a lot of the volatility in the market recently has been because of concerns about what the Fed's going to do.
Now, because the trade war between the U.S. and China was started by President Trump with the tariffs, he could stop that trade war if he wants. If things start to get ugly, he could say, okay, we've reached an agreement and there's no more trade war. And maybe then all of a sudden things look a little better in the markets.
I mean, I certainly think that would lift a cloud of uncertainty from many, many businesses, not just in the U.S., but in China and the rest of the world. Tariffs, don't forget, are not just about the direct cost increases that are paid by the importers and then subsequently, in many cases, by the consumer. There's also the secondary drag of uncertainty. But I think it would make a difference why the tariffs were lifted, if you've managed to get a wholesale deal with China that involved them opening up their markets, or if it was some kind of fudge that would impact how much difference it would make to the economy long term.
Star Sebastian, business correspondent at CNN. Thank you.
Thank you.
As George H.W. Bush is laid to rest, our next guest is keenly aware that his work moves closer to the history books, and he hopes he got it right. David Valdez was Bush's official photographer starting in his vice presidency, and he joins us now. David, first, such a loss for you. We're so sorry.
He actually one time in an interview said that he and Barbara Bush considered me a part of their family. And I was honored by that, but also was fully aware that I was a staff person.
An important one. Let's start with a picture that you took during Bush's vice presidency. He was on a family vacation in Kennebunkport, Maine. Life magazine was preparing a big piece. They wanted to send their photographer. Barbara Bush said no.
Well, I asked her about it, and I said, you know, we've got this thing with Life magazine, and what are your thoughts? And she was the one that said, well, come on by about 6 o'clock in the morning, and let's just see what happens. And so I went up to the house and poked my head in the bedroom door, and there was George and Barbara Bush in bed. Then the grandchildren started coming in, and I stood up, took that snap, and wound up running two full pages in Life, and it's taken on a life of its own.
Right. Some are crediting this with launching his presidential campaign. And I love these photos because this is not a fancy schmancy place on Kennebunkport. I mean, many have envied it, its position right jutting out into the Atlantic. But there's all the books haphazard on the bookshelf. There's the patterned sheets and the dust ruffle around the bed. And there's both George and Barbara with their bedheads. Woken up. Everybody's in these flannel PJs.
The most important thing to him, family, faith, and friends.
Well, we see certainly family in this picture. They're like puppies in a pile all over them in the bed. And I love the clashing wallpaper and the curtains. Just a lot of people can recognize this. We'll have all the pictures at hereandnow.org. David Valdez, you were also there when Jeb and Columba Bush brought their newborn, Jebby, to meet his grandparents. It was in a hotel room. All the staff left so that they could have this moment with Jebby, this grandchild. But there you are, with a grandfather looking into his grandson's eyes for the first time. What a picture.
Yeah, absolutely. Believe it or not, that literally was my first day on the job. all the staff that were there, the Secret Service, everybody left the room. And I was looking around. Nobody said anything to me. And then I started thinking about Yoshi Okamoto and David Kennerly and some of those. Mm-hmm. I thought, well, you know, those guys would have stayed in the room, so I'm going to stay. And I took some pictures.
I just have to jump in and say, you were thinking of other photographers and the potential moment in history. You were thinking of that when you were standing there.
Yeah, yeah. You know, there's when you think about some of the famous photos that come out, those intimate moments are captured by the presidential photographers.
Some other moments in Bush history you were there for. There's a photo in 1991, Bush walking along on the South Lawn, very rainy day. He's got a trench raincoat on,
right,
looking very contemplative. You say it was taken just hours before he announced the start of what would be called Operation Desert Storm. When there were these very tense White House moments, did you try to be invisible? What was your thought then?
I was fortunate to have developed the trust and personal relationship with President Bush during the years when he was vice president. I was just a known figure that was going to be there. And in the Oval Office, especially during the beginning of the Gulf War, there were a lot of highly classified meetings that I was in. And they trusted me. And it was an incredible time.
Your thoughts of him at those moments, I mean, we know Reagan oversaw the fall of the Berlin Wall, but it was George H.W. Bush who helped unify Germany.
President Reagan went to Germany and he said, "Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall." And it was during the George Bush's presidency that the Berlin Wall physically came down. A lot of the political people said, "Well, you know, Mr. President, you need to go and wave the flag and say, hey, you know, we won the Cold War." And he said, no, you know, it's not our victory, it's their victory. He wanted to give credit to them for moving forward and honestly to defeat communism and end the Cold War and to not fire a single bullet was one of those accomplishments that will go down in long-term history.
Some of the other thinking about George H.W. Bush, that he was a little detached from people. There's that moment when he saw a supermarket scanner and he was like, wow, what's that? You know, implying it into his own food shopping. He said he wasn't as shocked as people thought, but there was the sense that he was of the elite or somewhat removed. But here I see this kitchen picture. It looks like, you know, just kind of a kitchen. There's a kid on the counter, on
right,
the kitchen counter. There's a can of Diet Pepsi. And he seems to be doing something at either a clam steam pot or...
Actually, they were cooking tamales. He and Paola Rendon, who was kind of the nanny and been with the family for decades, at that moment, they were done and he was pulling them out of the steam pot there.
And I understand, was there a moment when you and some of the Bush men were standing around that pot eating the tamales right out of the pot? And what happened?
Yeah, here we are. The tamales were done. I was in the kitchen with George W. and Jeb. And we're looking around and we knew the tamales were done and we just started pulling them out of the pot and eating the tamales. And Mrs. Bush walked in and she kind of slammed her hand on the counter there and said, "I don't feed animals in my house." And so, you know, I skedaddled on out of there and we all sat down at the table.
Was there ever a time that you saw George Bush, who was said to, you know, remember the Wimp Factor cover that claimed that he was just too passive? Did you ever see him lose his temper? Was there a moment when he was more human than we're hearing? You know, he seems so perfect in so many ways. And you just said, "I'm not raising my lens."
Yeah, no, but you know, that Wimp Factor thing, he was really disappointed. You know, the evolution of that cover, he was going up to Kenny Bunkport and he saw in the Washington Post style section that one of the reporters from Newsweek was going to a wedding up there. And so he invited the reporter to fly up and it may have been on Air Force Two. They land and they go to the house, had lunch and nice time. And then the reporter leaves and goes off to the wedding. And then the next week, that cover comes out. And it was like, where does that come from? When you have a combat decorated war veteran, and then somebody says, "Oh, this guy's a wimp." I was like, are you kidding me?
David Valdez, it strikes me that we have all, you know, the country has lost a former president. You've really had a loss here of someone you've looked at through a lens for decades.
Yeah, it breaks my heart, you know, and that experience changed my life forever. If that hadn't happened, if I hadn't gone to work for George Herbert Walker Bush, I don't know what I'd be doing in my life. Yeah. That really dramatically changed my life.
Well, and open a window into another life for all of us.
You know, when 2 or 3 years ago I was visiting with him in Kennebunkport, and we had a little bit of time to just sit and talk and kind of laughed and reminisced about things. And then the last time I actually saw him was at the funeral of Barbara Bush. And then a day or two after that, you know, he went into the hospital. And I thought to myself, wow, this guy has a broken heart. And, you know, it was just 8 months later that he passed away.
Yeah. Lost his wife of, what, 73 years?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty amazing.
Yeah. David Valdez, George H.W. Bush's personal photographer. David, thank you so much again for this curtain that you pull back. Thank you.
Thank you. You know, I do a lot of public speaking, and sometimes I go and just tell stories and people start crying. Now I'm going to be the one standing up on the stage crying.
Yeah.
So it'll be interesting to see, you know, where he fits into the history of U.S. presidents.
Well, your pictures will help inform that decision. David, thank you.
Thank you.
Police in Australia say they've made an arrest in a cold case from 1982 that is the subject of a popular podcast. Chris Dawson has been charged with murdering his wife, Lynette. Nearly 30 million people have followed the story of her disappearance and the botched investigation through the Teacher's Pet podcast. Investigators around the world are using podcasts to renew attention to unsolved cases. Elliot Wenzler from member station WPLN in Nashville explains why a private investigator in Tennessee is launching her own podcast to help solve a mysterious death.
Hey, how are you?
It's good to meet you finally.
You too.
During a sweltering afternoon this summer, Sheila Wysocki gathered a group of podcasters, private investigators, true crime fans, and producers.
Hey, I'm so happy that you came.
They met at a recording studio in the Nashville suburb of Franklin over a Chick-fil-A buffet.
We are here to launch the podcast on the Lauren Agee case.
The show, called Without Warning, tells the story of Lauren Agee, a 21-year-old from nearby Hendersonville, Tennessee. Agee was found dead in July 2015 at the foot of a cliff during a popular wakeboarding contest in DeKalb County. The death was ruled an accident, but Agee's family hired Wysocki to investigate further. Wysocki became a PI almost 15 years ago when she decided to look into her former college roommate's murder. Now, she's working on another possible homicide, but this time, she's using a different method to solve it, podcasting.
The Lauren Agee case was hastily closed by authorities, but many questions remain. Come behind the curtain with private investigator Sheila Wysocki as she uncovers the truth about what happened to Lauren. This is Without Warning.
Wysocki is spearheading something she's calling crowdsourced investigations. The idea is simple. As she learns new information, she puts out episodes detailing what she's found in hopes of re-energizing the case. This tactic of crowdsourcing information isn't a new idea. Police frequently ask the public for help through press releases or televised press conferences. Podcasting seems to have unique advantages. One police department in California realized this when investigating a 2012 homicide. Police in Newport Beach had been trying to track down the victim's husband and primary suspect, a millionaire named Peter Chadwick. They featured the facts of the case on local and national news outlets to no avail. Then, one employee at the department had an idea.
Welcome to the prologue of Countdown to Capture. I'm Jennifer Mandela, and I'll be hosting this podcast about Peter Chadwick. And who am I? Well, I'm not a reporter, and I'm not a true crime enthusiast, and I'm certainly not a disinterested third party. I am the spokesperson for the Newport Beach Police Department.
Since they launched the podcast called Countdown to Capture in mid-September, Manzella says police are getting multiple tips a day. People are commenting that they're connecting to the case emotionally and finally getting invested in the details of what happened, even though all of that information was already available, just in a different format.
With the podcast, we're going out and finding people where they're driving on their commute or mowing their lawn or listening during their morning run. We're meeting them where they are instead of asking them to suspend what they're doing for their day and come watch our press conference.
But true crime and investigative shows also open themselves up to challenges and criticisms. For the Newport Beach Police, one came from the American Bar Association Journal, which worried that the podcast could violate suspect Peter Chadwick's Fourth Amendment rights because a listener could see it as an incitement for an illegal search. Other shows have been faulted for not solving the case, like Serial, or seeming to sensationalize or misrepresent facts. Payne Lindsay is the host of the podcasts Up and Vanished and Atlanta Monster, and says it can be challenging to parachute into these communities, dive into some emotional topics, and then package it into a show.
It's a fine line remaining sensitive to every aspect of this real-life case and their families and everything else, and also creating something that will hook people enough to want to come back next week.
To Lindsay, it's ultimately about finding ways to connect listeners to meaningful, true stories. To Sarah Mayu, a Vanderbilt assistant professor of law and history, these shows have even greater potential to help reveal cracks in the criminal justice system.
I don't know that podcasts alone are going to solve all of the problems with criminal justice, but to the extent that they are one more factor that's increasing public awareness, then yeah, I think that it could be part of this mix of factors that ultimately leads to some changes.
And that's part of the reason why Psaki got into investigating in the first place. To put accountability back on law enforcement and hopefully spark some change, she says. In the Lauren Agee case, she hopes the podcast will do that. Sheriff Patrick Ray in DeKalb County hasn't reopened the case, but he did tell WPLN he was aware of the show. At the very least, Wysocki says tips are pouring in.
Those podcasts, we had 8 ready. We're not using any of them because everything's already changed.
Wysocki doesn't plan to stop producing episodes until she feels she's figured out how Lauren Agee died. As long as there are tips coming in, she'll keep her listeners updated and the podcast feed fresh. For Here and Now, I'm Elliot Wenzler.
I don't know if we'll solve any crimes, but you can check out the Here and Now podcast on iTunes. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.